There was an article published by the BBC some years ago, but it was about a 62-year-old man in France suffering from stomach pains. It got so bad that he could not eat or go to the bathroom. When he got to the hospital, the doctors noticed that his stomach had been significantly swollen, and after examining the x-ray, they noticed a huge mass in this man's stomach. According to the doctors, it equaled the size and weight of a bowling ball, 12 pounds to be exact. Unfortunately, when the surgeon operated on his stomach, the man died a few days later from complications. Now, the $60,000 question is this, and no pun intended, but what in the world was in this man's stomach? To the medical staff's surprise, it was not a malignant tumor, definitely not a baby. Then what was it? It was money, about 350 coins filling his stomach. Consumed over a course of 10 years, this man literally ingested $650 worth of metal coins. Now, while consuming more and more money was a result of this man's strange neurological disorder, this could also be the result of man's spiritual disorder. And this spiritual disorder is what King Solomon addresses in the next part of Ecclesiastes. As most of you know, Solomon had lots and lots of money. He was loaded, as they say. So if anyone was an expert on money, it was Solomon. He had so much of it that I think he's able to experiment with it, study it, and examine how humans can have a spiritually disordered relationship with money. In other words, rather than having mastery over money, money oftentimes ends up having mastery over us. I mean, let's be honest. How many of you ever go throughout the week, let alone the day, without thinking at all about money? Even if you're not working and you're retired, even if somebody is a millionaire or even a billionaire with plenty of savings, I bet one can still be thinking about their money. And many of us just don't think about it, but we struggle with it. It can make us angry. It can get our adrenaline pumping. It keeps us awake at night. Some can be hit with a nervous breakdown or even a heart attack because of it. It also can cause conflict, separating family members, dividing close friends. Some of you might even be getting flashbacks, even as I speak, to some past struggle with money. But you and I know it's easy to get really emotionally charged when it comes to money. It can control us and make us behave in odd ways, even self-destructive ways. Well, as we move on in the book of Ecclesiastes, King Solomon helps us to gain a better perspective when it comes to your money, to master it rather than letting it master you. And the first is this: when money masters you, it will increase dissatisfaction. Increase dissatisfaction. In other words, how do you know when you're beginning to succumb to the money master? Well, check your sense of discontentment. Put your spiritual finger to the air and feel how strong the winds of dissatisfaction are whirling in your heart. Go to verses 8 to 10. Solomon says in chapter 5, "If you see the poor oppressed in the district, and justice and rights denied, do not be surprised at such things. For one official is eyed by a higher one, and over them both are others higher still. The increase from the land is taken by all. The king himself profits from the fields. Whoever loves money has never enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. This too is meaningless." Solomon reminds us, hey, don't be surprised by the corruption from the lower levels to the higher levels in the societal hierarchy. We live in a world where everyone's fighting for a piece of the monetary pie. Everyone wants more and more coins to fill their insatiable stomachs. But Solomon points out that whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with what he has. This craving for more only feeds the craving for more. It only exacerbates discontentment and dissatisfaction, which is why one might keep striving for more. This is why Paul says in 1 Timothy 6, he says, "For the love of money is the root of all evils." I often hear people misquoting passages like this by saying that money is the root of all evils. Money itself is not evil. Money, like a coin or a check or a wad of cash, is just an inanimate object. And so the thing itself does not possess any inherent value, but it's the value we place on it. I mean, you can use paper, you can choose tree bark, leaves, cotton balls, gum, it doesn't matter. But those things only have value once we place a value on it. It's interesting, for example, when I see kids trading certain Pokemon cards. I mean, you would think they're holding it like a surgeon handling a fresh kidney in the middle of a kidney transplant. It's like diamond and gold to them. Or on the other hand, think about the famous picture of a German woman during World War I who was throwing stacks of money literally into a fireplace to heat her home. The inflation was so high back then that it was cheaper to use the cash to create a fire than to use a pallet of wood or a barrel full of coal. In other words, we all know that the object itself doesn't determine the value. We do. Which is why the Apostle Paul and King Solomon do not say that the one having money never has enough, or that the one making money is never satisfied. Because the problem is not the amount of cash, a lot or a little. The problem ultimately stems from my heart. When a young rich man approached Jesus in Luke 18 and asking Jesus about eternal life, Jesus told him to sell all of his possessions to the poor and follow him. Now, Jesus didn't say that because he had a lot of money. He didn't say that because God needs his money, and Jesus did not ask this of everyone he met, but he in particular singled out this wealthy man because Jesus knew he had a heart problem when it came to the abundance of his possessions. Jesus was helping this man to confront, in other words, his greater love, to identify what his true master was. It's no wonder why 16 out of the 38 of Christ's parables deal with money. I mean, that's almost half of all his parables. Moreover, when you read through the New Testament, you'll find that more is said about money than about heaven and hell combined. Prayer is hugely important when it comes to our relationship with God, but while there are over 100 verses on the topic of prayer and faith, there are over 2,000 verses dealing with money and possessions. Why? Because God knows the kind of spell money can have on us. Not because of the amount, but because of our hearts. While being one of the wealthiest men in history, John D. Rockefeller was asked how much he wanted, and he said, "Just a little bit more." Somebody once said, "Money makes a lousy lover. The more you love it, the less it satisfies. The more you focus on it, the less it delivers." Unfortunately, despite all the warnings all throughout Scripture, we still somehow allow money to have mastery over us. And you know that it does when you can begin to sense the thorns of dissatisfaction and discontentment poking at your heart. Secondly, when money masters you, it will increase loss. In other words, you know that money is beginning to take the master's role in your life when you begin to lose more important and valuable things in your life. Solomon says in verse 11 now, "As goods increase, so do those who consume them. And what benefit are they to the owner except to feast his eyes on them?" I like how another Bible translation states it, "The more loot you get, the more looters show up. And what fun is that to be robbed in broad daylight?" King Solomon is saying that the man gaining for more only ends up getting taken for more. It's like a pile of manure. It only attracts more flies into your life. Here's one article that said this about a lottery winner. He said, "Winning the lottery isn't always what it's cracked up to be," says Evelyn Adams, and who won the New Jersey lottery not just once, but think about this, twice, to the tune of $5.4 million. The article goes on to say this: today the money is all gone and Adams lives in a trailer. I won the American dream, but I lost it too, she says. It was a very hard fall. It's called rock bottom. Everybody wanted my money. Everybody had their hand out. The article goes on to say that Adams eventually lost all her money at the slot machines in Atlantic City. Here's another story. William Post won $6.2 million in the Pennsylvania lottery, but now lives on his Social Security. I wish it never happened, he said. It was a total nightmare. A former girlfriend successfully sued him for a share of his winnings, and it wasn't his only lawsuit. A brother was arrested for hiring a hitman to kill him, hoping to inherit a share of the winnings. Other siblings pestered him until he agreed to invest in the car business and a restaurant, two ventures that brought no money back and further strained his relation with the siblings. Post even spent time in jail for firing a gun over the head of a bill collector. Within a year, he was $1 million in debt. Post admitted he was both careless and foolish, trying to please his family, and eventually declared bankruptcy. Now he lives quietly on $450 a month in food stamps, and he said, I'm tired. I'm over 65 years old, and I just had a serious operation for a heart aneurysm. You may never come into some major windfall or win the lottery, but it doesn't mean that it can't steal some very valuable things from you. Loss of health, loss in a relationship, loss of peace of mind, as one has to hire more people to manage all the money, lawyers, tax consultants, accountants, bankers, brokers, financial consultants to help direct all that money into the right place. And then you start to realize that other people who want more money start to get jealous. They get angry with you because of all your money. And now you're starting to wonder if you need to move to another city or another state because of all the crazy people who are trying to swarm into your life. I remember somebody telling me that he was beginning to get threats on Facebook from people within his social circles because he was doing so well financially and because they felt like he wasn't helping them. So the love of money, when it begins to take mastery over your heart, can perhaps be measured by the sort of losses one accumulates with the more important and valuable things in their life. Thirdly, when money masters you, it will increase worry. More worry might mean that money is taking the master's seat in your heart. Look in verse 12. The sleep of a laborer is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of a rich man permits him no sleep. This very wealthy man has no time to unwind. Even if he wants to, he can't. Because he's worried about, let's say, the competition that can eat into his profit margins. He's worried about all he has to oversee. He's constantly getting emails and phone calls about some crisis or some legal issue, which only increases more stress, more anxiety, and more sleepless nights. I remember a young man was interviewed. He said that after he sold a best-selling book and gained boatloads of money off all the sales, he said it was very strange. He said it was only when he began getting all this money that he then started to worry about all of his money. What about you? What are you worried about? Do I have enough saved for retirement? I mean, you're watching your 401k get pummeled. You feel the anxiety levels go up as you have to pay now $8 for a certain carton of $8 for a carton of eggs. You're constantly hearing about a looming recession. Some of us feel the agitation when we're balancing our checkbooks and thinking about all the bills that we have to pay. Others are worried about what would happen if they get laid off or if they'll be able to find a secure job or career to support the family. And it doesn't matter if you have a lot or a little. I mean, you think the abundance of this rich man that Solomon speaks of would be what permits a man sleep. I mean, isn't that why we pursue riches? Isn't it to achieve a greater degree of security and peace? And yet Solomon says it tends to do the very opposite because he still feels like he doesn't have enough. They say that the main reason people in our culture cannot sleep is because of anxiety. And the primary cause of anxiety are worry about money. There's a story about Johnny Rockefeller, and it said that Rockefeller's life was almost ruined by wealth. At the age of 53, he was the world's only billionaire. Apparently, he was earning about $1 million a week. But he said while he was making all of this money, he was miserable. He said he was sick all the time, and all he ate was crackers and milk. And he said he couldn't sleep because, he said, I was always worried. Fourthly, when money masters you, it will increase pain. You know that money has taken mastery over your heart and life when you can see behind you a trail of pain and grief. You know, life can be painful enough as it is, but we unnecessarily add unnecessary heartache when we let money become our master. Look in verse 13. I've seen a grievous evil under the sun, wealth hoarded to the harm of its owner. Again, having a lot of money is not the issue. Making a lot of money is not the problem. While it's unbiblical to endorse a sort of prosperity gospel, it's also unbiblical to preach a poverty gospel. There are plenty of godly people in the Bible who are blessed with tremendous wealth. I mean, Solomon asked for wisdom, and God blessed him also with riches. Think about Lydia, who had a lucrative clothing business, but also helped the Apostle Paul plant a church in the city of Thyatira. Or how about Job or Abraham? How about Joseph of Arimathea, who was described as the rich man, but also a disciple of Jesus and the one who provided the very expensive tomb for Jesus' burial? In fact, all throughout the Bible, we read of God wanting to lead his people to the land flowing with milk and honey, meaning a land of enormous prosperity, which is why Solomon did not say wealth to the harm of its owner, but wealth hoarded to the harm of its owner. This is about the orientation of one's heart. This is about where one's head is aimed at when it comes to money. 1 Timothy 6 says this, but those who want to be rich fall into temptation, a trap, and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge people into ruin and destruction. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs. It doesn't say that money pierced them with pains. It says they pierced themselves with many pains. No wonder why Andrew Carnegie said this, quote, millionaires seldom smile. You know, so many people are unwillingly infected with influenza, but so many others are willingly infecting themselves with affluenza. Affluenza has so many painful symptoms, stress, back pain, high blood pressure, fights, lawsuits, exhaustion. James 1 says, but each person is tempted when they are dragged away by their own evil desires and enticed. Then after desire is conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. This is why the Bible tells us to what? Examine ourselves. Who is really my God? What is really my God? Am I really living my life in the faith? So from time to time, I need to take a step back and check my motivations. What is driving me? Why am I getting so upset? How can my emotions get all triggered and I get all riled up whenever the topic of money comes up? How come I'm so invested in this relationship and not another one? Is it because of my ulterior motives? A study that was done, and it found that wiser husbands who place a high value on possessions were more likely to experience financial problems. In fact, it said that very materialistic couples had a 40% higher risk of having a financial problem than other couples, as well as a greater increase of marital problems and unhappiness. And you're probably already aware of this, but what sort of role finances play in a marriage are one of the top five, if not the top three, reasons that marriages end up in divorce. I remember this married couple who had just started attending our church, but the wife told us that they used to have a very expensive lifestyle. They were in the real estate business and capitalized on the gold rush during the height of the housing market, and they were just working their brains out, made tons and tons of money. But when we talked further, the husband admitted that it was also the period in which they had the most strain and conflict in their marriage. But then he said that it was only when they began to scale down on their expenses and their work hours and simplify their lifestyle and increase their involvement in the church community that he said their marriage started to get better. He said, we're so much happier now. Perhaps you know people that have a trail of broken relationships, bitterness, and conflict because of the amount of energy and time spent on hoarding for more. Perhaps you can reflect back on a period in your life where you got sidetracked too. Some of you have even experienced the consequences. Some of you, by the grace of God, nearly escaped ruin, whether it was with gambling or jumping into a hasty investment or racking up purchases on your credit card or working longer and longer hours to the detriment of your own health, your key relationships, and ultimately serving God. And some of us, even after all these years, having plenty of time to master this one area of our lives, are still struggling with how money keeps taking the place as master. You think that after 30 or 40 or 50 years dealing with the same thing, we would be a master with that which we operate and handle over and over, right? We'd be very skilled and amazing at it, fixing cars, cooking a meal, building a house. And yet, what about money even after all these years, as it still dictates how you react and behave and make decisions, because it's still your master? Fifthly, when money masters you, it will increase junk. You notice how these days garages are no longer used for cars? It's just an additional storage unit. I mean, I look down my neighborhood and see that everyone parks their cars now in the driveway. You think that in the Phoenix heat, they'd want to park their cars in their garages, only to realize that when they open up their garages, it's filled with loads and loads of stuff. What about you? What does your garage look like? And I'm not talking about your literal physical garage. I'm talking about the storage garage of your heart. Look at verse 14 through 17. Or wealth lost through some misfortune, so that when he has a son, there's nothing left for him. Naked a man comes from his mother's womb, and as he comes, so he departs. He takes nothing from his labor that he can carry in his hand. This too is a grievous evil. As a man comes, so he departs. And what does he gain since he toils for the wind? All his days he eats in darkness with great frustration, affliction, and anger. Why does this man eat in darkness in great frustration, in affliction, and anger? Because at the end of our lives, the very things we've worked so hard to accumulate, we realize is just junk. We spent so much on dead temporal things rather than investing in living eternal things. Paul says again in 1 Timothy 6, "For we brought nothing into the world and we can take nothing out of it." If life seems to last like a split second, Paul's saying, then why did we try to accumulate things that can only be held for a split second? Remember when I bought a big bottle of like expensive juice with me to the airport, and before I was able to get to my gate, the TSA officer told me that I had to throw it away. I couldn't take it with me. I was like, well, that was a waste. I just bought that huge bottle for nothing. When we fly to heaven, there's not even space for carry-on luggage. You can't take anything with you. Every year, Forbes magazine publishes a special report on the top earning dead celebrities. Among the top 10 are Kobe Bryant, David Bowie, Elvis Presley, Charles Schulz, and James Brown. These people earned a lot of money when they were alive, but they seem to be making even more now that they're dead. That's why Jesus says in Matthew 6, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moths and vermin destroy, where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moths and vermin do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal." We can't take junk with us, but we can store jewels for us. And we can store these jewels for ourselves by how you and I master our money. So how about you? Is money your master, or are you learning to master your money? Jesus said in Matthew 6, "No one can serve two masters. You cannot serve both God and money." Are you a slave to money, or are you a steward for God? See, a slave is chained, but a steward is free. Are you chained, or are you free? And you know you're free when you are cheerfully generous. You are free when you bless others with it. You're free when you know that God is your provider and they will keep providing as you continue to steward what he has freely given you. Paul says in 1 Timothy 6, command those who are rich to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. In this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves. So where are you when it comes to mastering money? When it comes to your finances, and you notice an increased sense of dissatisfaction, loss, worry, pain, and junk in your life, then perhaps I can help you to check your heart. It might be time to once again lay all that at the feet of Jesus. In the following verse, after Jesus challenges us to think about who our master really is, he says, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they? Yet I tell you that not even Solomon in all of his splendor was dressed like one of these. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. So where are you when it comes to mastering money? If you really want to serve him, let God master your money.